It is July 22nd, 2011. It is a Friday, and we are interviewing Bridget Wanderer at her home in Missoula, Montana. Would you like to state your name and then your place and date of birth for the record, please?
Yes, Bridget Rye Wanderer, and I was born in Missoula, Montana, 1953.
And did you grow up in this area?
I grew up in Spokane. We moved when I was about two. And so I grew up in Spokane. Both sides of my family are from Montana, and so we kind of lived here anyway, you know. And so Montana to me was much more home than Spokane was.
And where all have you lived besides, anywhere else besides Spokane and Missoula?
Oh yeah. I went to school for 2 years in Seattle after high school, and then came back here and actually spent 10 years, and then went to Bozeman and graduated there, and then pretty much hit the road. I lived in Olympia, Washington, Cortez, Colorado, North Dakota, Yellowstone Park, Denver, Atlanta, New Orleans, the Virgin Islands.
Wow. So what jobs have you had?
Most of that moving was done when I was an engineer for the National Park Service.
Okay.
So.
Interesting. And are you married?
No.
Okay. Do you have any children?
No.
Okay. So when did your ancestors leave Ireland?
It depends on the family. I have kind of two families of Irish people that came over. My mother, even though her last name was Hefner, her maiden name was Hefner, which is very German, was three quarters Irish. Her mother was a Murphy, and her mother's, her grandmother's maiden name was Gallagher. They were from County Mayo. And on the other side, on my grandfather's side, my mother's father, he of course was a Hefner, but his mother was a Murphy. And different family entirely, of course, and they were from County Wexford. And that family came over in 1847. I guess that was the peak year of immigration for the potato famine. Mm-hmm. And they had four or five children with them. My great-grandmother wasn't among them. They had 14 eventually. And then she was one of the last three. She was second to the last of 14. And she was born in Illinois. They came to actually Utica, New York first, and I haven't tracked down who they met there. They must have had a relative there. Mm-hmm. But within 3 years, by the 1850 census, they're in Illinois, northern Illinois, far northwest corner. And I think it's because of the mining activity in the area. And her father was Nicholas, her mother was Anastasia. And so very kind of un-Irish names. And from what I understand, having taken like an Irish history class at the university, County Wexford is way on the southeast corner of Ireland on the coast, and that was one of the counties more heavily impacted by the invasion of, you know, in 2000, whenever, I can't remember what the dates were, but anyway, they have a strong Nordic influence there, and so I think that that's the difference between the two families. The other family, the Gallaghers, and then my great-grandmother married a Murphy, were from County Mayo, and they came one at a time. There were 14 children in the family, and the parents never immigrated, but all the children did, and they came one at a time, and I have records of six of them. The other ones I haven't tracked down yet. I just recently found the names of the parents, Patrick Gallagher and Mary Hastings. And because they came one at a time, sometimes they were married and sometimes they weren't. My namesake, Bridget Gallagher Cavanaugh, appears to have had a shipboard romance because she and her husband are both on a passenger list, but they're separate and they're unmarried, and they're going to different cities. One's going to Philadelphia and one's going to New York. But they were married out here, so I kind of think that that's what happened, but I don't know for sure. They're kind of very different families. The Gallagher family are just very short. My grandmother was 4'11". Her brothers were pretty much the same height and a little bit taller. And so you know, and the ancestors kind of came down that way. The County Wexford Murphys were very tall. Mary Murphy was, this is a picture of them in Yellowstone when she was an older woman. And this is her. And granted, it's probably a slight upslope, but you can tell she's pretty tall.
Wow.
Yeah. And her daughters were like 6 foot tall. And they were my great aunts. My grandfather was very big man. He was like 6'4" and towered over everybody. This shows it a little bit, you know, that the other guys are substantially shorter than he was. Just a very big man. And I remember Lula, his older sister Lula, who was the oldest of the four children. I met her when I was 7 here in Missoula, and she lived in the Wilma building. And we went up to see her, and she opened the door, and, you know, it was eye level for me, for her hand, you know, around the door, and I have never seen a hand like that in my life. It looked like a whole palm, another half a palm, and then all these fingers. And I was just like, wow, you know, and I was 7. And so that makes me believe all my mother's stories about my grandfather's huge hands, you know. And I have one brother who took after the tall people in the family, and his sons are 6'3 and 6'4 and big guys too, and the rest of us are short. So they're kind of diametrically opposed when it comes to height, at least. Both families were Roman Catholic, mm-hmm. At least then, you know, I would say that only part of the family stayed Roman Catholic. The Murphys that went to Illinois, a lot of them stayed there. I've seen information in the area. I guess it's my great-great-grandfather, Nicholas. He had a son named Nicholas also, and I have the probate papers for him. And he stayed in the area and was a pretty successful businessman. I haven't tracked down all of them yet. They did have the three youngest children, William, Mary, and Margaret. Mary came out here because of William. I'm certain of that. She came out at the age of 19 on a stagecoach to Helena. And I pretty much think it was like she had no prospects in Illinois. You know, her dad had died several years earlier, and they probably were living in, you know, fairly abject poverty. And so she came out here, and I've always wondered why. And then I tracked down records, and William was here. And he was working in the mines in like Marysville and places like that. And so she came out and taught school north of Helena, I think is it Canyon Creek, something like that. It's a teeny tiny town. And it's still there. They had a reunion a couple years ago that I went to. And then she was teaching in Marysville when my great-grandfather and she married. So that's how she came out here. And then she had a younger sister, Margaret, by a couple years. And Margaret came out after Mary did. And I just recently, this year, found that she came up on the Missouri on a boat to Fort Benton. And then I'm not sure how she got to Helena. I don't know if it was stage or exactly what. But then it turns out that Mary and Margaret married two brothers, Charles and Adolf. Yeah. Mary and Adolf married before Margaret and Charles did. And Margaret and Charles were the witnesses at their wedding. Mary was married in Helena at the cathedral that preceded the cathedral that's there now. There was another cathedral on a different site by a different name. And they were married at that cathedral, and then that was torn down. And I think the diocese still owns the land. I've got the history somewhere of the installation. And then the big cathedral was built.
Huh.
But, yeah.
Interesting. Do you know what Margaret did when she came out?
As far as I know, well, no, I don't. And before she got married, I don't. I know that after she got married, she was just a housewife, and Charles seemed to do pretty well. He was a clerk in a store, a men's store, I think, and he and Adolf were the members of the Sons and were the Montana Pioneers. They were both here before like 1869 or something like that, and so they were both in the Montana Pioneers, and Charles seemed to be much more of a joiner. He lived in Helena, for starters, and had a job where probably had some free time to go to meetings and stuff, whereas Adolf homesteaded in Helmville. He mined for a few years, 3 years or something like that, and then homesteaded in Helmville, and probably didn't have a whole lot of time to travel to meetings. And it looks like there was a lot, there was contact between the siblings. There was never any, estrangement. In Margaret's obituary, it mentions that William visited often, you know, and then Charles and Margaret had one daughter, and the cousins knew each other. They were double cousins because their mothers mm-hmm. and fathers were both related. And so I have pictures of my great aunts with their double cousin, you know, so there was still a lot of family visiting there, just not a lot of family, you know. Mm-hmm. Mary had four children, and Margaret had one who did not have any children, any descendants.
Do you know anything about either the Gallagher family or the Murphy family while they were in Ireland, about their lives?
Not really. Mm-mm.
But you assume that they came because of the famine, because they came during the peak years.
Right, yeah. And I do know that the Gallaghers had some kind of property. I don't know what if it was an interest actually owned in fee or if it was like a rented property or whatever, because I do know I got in contact with some descendants, actually, and they had actually been to Ireland and been to that property. And because all the children came, it was just like periphery relatives left. There was some woman that lived there that had some kind of contact with the family. And but that's all I know. Mm-hmm. So there was some kind of land.
Okay. What would you say your Irish ancestry means to you?
I think it means a lot, and part of it because it meant a lot to my mother, and that's one reason why I started doing genealogy, is because I wondered, where did all those Irish ancestors go, and all my mother's Irish cousins, because she used to talk about all the cousins coming out to the ranch in the summer, you know, at Helmville, and we, you know, tons of photographs and pictures and all that kind of stuff, and I thought, where'd they all go? You know, in one generation, what happened, you know? And I had met one of her cousins, Father George Murphy, who later became a Monsignor, but that's the only one that I'd really met. And so I just had a lot of curiosity about that. And I wondered, where in Ireland did they come from?
Mm-hmm. So you say there was a ranch in Helmville, mm-hmm. but your ancestors did kind of a variety of things, from mining to shopkeeping. So do you know anything mm-hmm. about the actual establishment of that ranch and who ran it when it was...
Yeah. My great-grandfather homesteaded, and he's where the German name comes from, Adolf Hefner. And he had come over in 1855. Crossed the country, actually stopped in Davenport, Iowa, like all Germans do, and then came across the country overland and was in California, actually up north in the mining area. The mines were starting to get played out by then. And then in 1861, he enlisted in the Union Army through the California Volunteers and fought in Idaho, actually. There's a Battle of Bear Creek that he fought at. And was discharged, I think it's Fort Randall, might have been Fort Douglas, outside Salt Lake City in 1864, and headed north to Montana and never left. I think he knew something about mining because of what the time he'd spent there up in Northern California, and so he headed to Montana. And as far as other people seeing where he was, supposedly he was at Butte Silver Bow Gulch, which apparently only had one building at the time, like one. We're talking early. And also Montana City, which is right outside Helena, Virginia City, Last Chance Gulch. And then when he came into the valley, the county history says that he had two mules. You know, so he at least saved his money from when he was, you know, and he homesteaded in Helmville. The family lore says that someone else wanted to homestead that particular land. It's bottom land on Nevada Creek, and it's nice, it's beautiful country, and it's good ranch land. And that Adolf's friends kind of detained that person so that Adolf could file first. And the family history in other aspects has been extremely accurate. The family history before I knew where he'd been in the Civil War said that he fought out west against the Indians, and that's exactly what happened. You know, happened. So I kind of tend to believe that there's some truth to that. And so he established a ranch, and he actually ranched for, probably 15 years. And he was in his early 40s when he married Mary, who was 22, which wasn't that uncommon back then. And so they ranched. They stayed there. They raised their kids there. When Adolf died, it was an unusual will in that he left equal shares of the ranch to all four children, which is unusual. Even today, a lot of ranchers will not leave land to girls. You know, they just won't do it. And so he did that, but he also left his wife as the executrix. You know, all the kids were between 13, I think, and 20 or something like that. And I don't know exactly what happened. I think my grandfather eventually bought out his siblings. Because I remember Lula and Bess back in the 20s and the 30s had money. And that's the only place they would have been able to get it is selling their share of the ranch. And so my grandfather took it over about 1920, 22, something like that, and ran it until I believe somewhere in the early 40s. And then economic issues, just he lost it. So, but my mother grew up there.
Okay. First of all, I'm curious about your last name.
Mm-hmm.
And so can you tell me a little bit where that comes from?
Yeah, of course it's my dad's last name, and it's German.
Mm-hmm.
The family came fairly late, well, late compared to some people, 1870 maybe, 80, something like that, and settled in Wisconsin. And my great-grandfather apparently, the family history is he didn't really get along with his father, and so he ran away as a teenager and came out here. And he homesteaded near Clancy, in near Helena, and he had four kids, and then including my great-grandmother, and then she got married to, she was a Kinsey, and married Wanderer. And then my grandfather was one of four children, and he married my grandmother and had eight. And so they moved in 1926, I think it was, from Clancy, my grandfather and grandmother, Clancy down to Elmville, or Hamilton. And my grandfather ran a grocery store there. So my mom and dad met in Helena. She was working. She had gone to school here, and she was in her third year and was president of her sorority, and her parents ran out of money. And so, you know, back then there was no recourse. There was no financial aid, nothing. And so she quit school and wound up in Helmville, in Helena somehow, working. And my dad had gone to school at Carroll and was kind of a little bit undecided about what to do. So he was working for one of the state agencies also. And so his future sister-in-law introduced them. So they met in Helena. And then they knew each other for 4 or 5 years before they got married.
Okay. So do you know anything about either the Murphy or the Gallagher names?
The two things I know are only from the that Irish history class that I took. I actually have something written out about Gallagher that was from the internet, and I kind of flashed by that, and I don't know where I put it right now. But the head of Irish studies, I can't remember his name, Terry?
Reardon?
Yeah, uh-huh. He said that, first of all, Murphy is like everywhere in Ireland. There's a lot of times when names are in an area. You know, Murphy apparently is pretty evenly spread everywhere. And he said it means calamity, which would be pretty close to. And then Gallagher, he said the G-A-L-L part in the Irish language, apparently, they had a term for outsider. It's kind of like he said the Irish and the Jewish people. It's like, you know, in with Jewish people, it's goyim. You know, it's got anybody that's not us, you know. And with the Irish, it's kind of the same way. They kind of the two cultures that have a word for everybody else. And in Ireland, I think it was G-A-L, something along that line. And actually, that's the first part of Gallagher. And so I don't know where they came from way back when, but apparently not over the centuries in Ireland, but as close as we can get there. So
that's interesting. Do you know if your name or any of those family names have undergone any changes, like dropped O's or Fitz or things like that?
Not that I know of. I do know that the youngest of the 14 of the children that came from County Mayo, Charles H. Gallagher, he married a woman who added an E to Kelly. And at the L-E-Y, and but other than that, I don't think there's been much of a change.
Are there any traditional first names in your family?
Yeah. As a matter of fact, I'm about ready to write a letter to my nephew with tongue in cheek about the name Nora. You can't count how many Noras there are in this family. You know, my great grandmother was a Nora. She had a daughter named Nora. Most of her children had a daughter named Nora. One of them married a woman named Nora. You know, when I saw that in the census, I thought, oh, they must have it wrong. It must not be a wife. It must be a daughter. You know, nope, it was his wife. He married a Nora. So we could probably come up with 8 Noras, you know. And the original first name for Nora was Honoria, H-O-N-O-R-I-A. And then Nora was the shortened version of it that they used. And then by the time they got past my great-grandmother, who was an Honoria, the actual name was shortened to Nora. And so that's probably the strongest. My name appears twice in my great-great-aunt and my name. And that was one of the reasons I kind of wanted to research too, because I wanted to find out, you know, what was it about her? Because I knew I was named after her, and when I went looking for her, I couldn't find her. Couldn't find her in the Montana census, I just thought, what? You know, and so finally, she had a son who was a Monsignor in the Catholic Church. So I finally thought, well, if I can't find the mother, let me see if I can find the son. So I called the diocese in Helena one day, and I said, you know, that I was looking for this Monsignor. I thought he was in their diocese, and, you know, could they help me with any information on the family? 30 seconds, I'm not kidding, 30 seconds later, she has everything about him. I mean, they keep tabs of you in the Catholic Church, where he was baptized, where he was, you know, had confirmation, first communion, ordination, you know. And he was head of Carroll College before he died. And so they knew about him, and they knew somewhat about his mother. And so I got his baptismal records from Livingston. That's where they'd lived when he was born. And it turns out that the reason I couldn't find her in the census is because it's transcribed wrong. And it's not even close to Bridget, you know. So there. But if you start looking, find out her husband's name, and then look for the husband, you can actually find her, you know. So anyway, she was a nice lady. Let's see. I have a picture. I have several pictures of her, actually. This is one picture. It's cute. I got to give it to you guys. That's in Butte, and that's her, and that's on St. Patrick's Day.
Oh, that's cute.
Yeah, Charles H. Gallagher gave that to me, and one of her nephews. And then this is one when she visited our home in Spokane, and that's me, and that's her. And then this is her, I think this is in Butte. That's her, that's Charles H., her younger brother. And this is James C., and they look about the same age, and they probably are. With 14 kids, you know, you have a pretty wide age range. This is their nephew. He's, yeah.
Wow.
he's one of the sons of one of the older kids. And when my mother decided to name me Bridget, I was baptized here at St. Anthony's, and the priest there was a Monsignor from Ireland. He was right, you know, and his comment was, sure, now Marjorie, you're not going to name that innocent child Bridget. And my mother said, I like it. It's a beautiful name. And yes, she's going to be named Bridget. And then I found out later that he was notorious for changing names in the middle of baptism. I mean, if he didn't like what the parents were doing, he'd just baptize him something else. And I don't think he wanted to take on my mother. I think he knew better than that. But the reason was because Bridget was such a common Irish name that all the maids were named Bridget. And actually, there, I guess there was an expression called, I need a Bridget.
You know?
And there was also the term old biddy supposedly comes from the name Bridget. And so a lot of the first generation Irish would not use the name even if they were called Bridget. And she was never called Bridget. She was called Aunt Bee. She was always called Bee. She was not called Bridget. And I've met other people who had female ancestors by the same name that were also called Bee because they did not want to use the name Bridget. So
that is really interesting. Are there any naming traditions you know of in your family, such as sons being named after uncles or anything of that sort?
Mm-mm. We do tend to name people after relatives in our family. I have one nephew who now has two children that were named after no one, which is really unusual in our family. And it's really hard sometimes in our family when you start talking, you have to use middle names because a lot of times you can't tell who you're talking about unless... You know, I got a LinkedIn the other day from Stephen Wander. I have three living relatives and one dead that are LinkedIn. I mean, that are, you know, I didn't know who it was. You know, I figured it was my nephew and it was, but it could have been my cousin and it could have been his kid.
Oh my gosh. So, what languages do you speak?
English.
Just English?
Yeah.
Okay. And did any of your older relatives speak Gaelic? That you know of?
No, huh? Not that I know of.
Okay. What are some of your childhood memories of, you know, various places where you grew up, of Missoula in particular?
It's funny because my dad, you know, being from Hamilton, that's where most of the sisters all stayed in Hamilton. Some of them went other places. The boys all went elsewhere. So when we came to Montana, we usually spent time mostly in Hamilton. And so, you know, I knew Hamilton really well. And we would go downtown, like my sister and I, you know, 7 and 8 years old, and take a check. You know, we'd stay for a month with my aunt, and dad would send us a check, you know, for just spending money. And we'd go to the bank teller, oh, you're Peter's girls, you know. And so, you know, everybody knew us. And that continued, and it still does to this day. I just joined a church downtown and somebody came up to me afterwards and wanted to know if I was related to Lucille. And yeah, yeah, as a matter of fact. So it's always been a place that, you know, you can run, but you can't hide kind of thing. And that's fine, you know. And when I worked at the bank in the 70s, and I really liked this, a lot of people from Helmville banked, you know, downtown at Western Montana Bank, which isn't, the building's not even a bank anymore. It's on the Higgins and Broadway. You know, we had our names up, you know, and I had so many people. As a matter of fact, a lot of these pictures I got because people gave them to me when they found out that I was in the area. They would come up, and the first lady was older lady I cashed a check for, and her daughter had an account with us, so she signed for it. And so the older lady put the money away, and usually people just step away. They're done, you know. Well, she stayed there for just a few seconds, and she looks at me, and she said, "Wasn't your mother a Hefner?" And I was like, yeah. And I tell you, I don't look like my mother. I look like my father. And I was just like, really? And I looked down at her check. She was from Avon. So the same area, you know, she had known my mother. And people would come up and lean on the counter and talk to me about my grandparents, you know. And that was really nice. I would have, I took advantage of it and I was interested in it, but I wish I would have done more about finding out history, you know. And one day I had a lady come in and she goes, it was a good thing it was me that was standing there. She goes, "Where's the Hefner granddaughter?" Nobody else would have known that. And so me. And she goes, "I have a footstool that was your grandfather's. He had worked in Finn before he died, and they apparently owned the ranch there." And so she goes, "Here's my phone number. Go to Avon, call me when you get to Avon, and I'll tell you how to get to Finn." And so I went over and picked it up. And like an idiot, I gave it to my brother. But supposedly it's still around. I don't know. So it's been an area that's been real familiar because I spent a lot of time here. And also there's a lot of roots here, you know. So that's, you know, Spokane was okay. Actually, it was a great neighborhood. You know, baby boomers, we had tons of kids in the neighborhood. You know, it was safe back then. You didn't have horrible people crawling all over, you know. We just spent all our days outside on our bikes, you know, playing, you know. And our parents never bothered to even worry about it because we always came home, you know. And so that was fun. And I have to say, I went to Catholic schools. And so a lot of the people that I went to school with were Irish Catholics, you know, Gillespies and Driscolls and, you know, so it was real common and just kind of, you know, McNamara's and Cronin's and, so it was like fitting in, you know, you never felt like you were, you know, somebody from somewhere else. And our neighborhood was, you know, phenomenally Catholic. I didn't think of that until later when somebody pointed out that there's little enclaves, especially in Spokane, where, you know, the neighborhood's almost 100% Catholic. And if you're not, you find out fast, you know. Mm-hmm. And so it was just kind of a cultural thing. Catholicism is a cultural thing, you know, when the church is a block away. And
How many siblings do you have?
Three.
Mm-hmm. And their names are?
Peter John Jr. is the oldest. Michael Joseph is the second. And then Mary Elizabeth is my older sister. And then I'm the youngest.
Okay. What games did you play when you were children?
You know, it's funny. There were so many kids that we all played with, kids our own age. And we didn't really play with each other, you know. And kickball, baseball, riding bikes. We had a pond just a block away in an old small park in Spokane. And so in the winter we skated and sledded, and in the summer we caught pollywogs and that kind of stuff. So,
what kind of toys did you play with?
Mostly dolls, I think, as far as toys go.
Okay. Were there any sort of craft traditions or homemade toys or anything in your family?
Mm-mm. My dad was the least mechanical person on the planet, and so were his brothers. I mean, it really runs in the family. So, I mean, if it didn't come from a store, we didn't have it.
How about storytelling or music? Were those big traditions in your family?
No. My mom, I think, probably told some stories, like I said, to you about my great-grandfather, and my sister remembers some also. They weren't super emphasized, but we did hear them, I think, because we, you know, were kind of interested in them. We might have heard more, but my grandmother, who was Elizabeth Murphy, in the very early 50s, moved back east to Virginia to be with my aunt, who had divorced and had a son to raise. And back then, it just wasn't common. There weren't daycares. There weren't anything like that. And so grandma was going back east. So she did. And I saw her, I think, once after that. And so if grandma had been around, we might have heard more, you know. But we heard some, but not a lot.
So for family gatherings and things, was music an important part of your family?
No, we weren't that kind. Nobody has any talent on our side. And our family gatherings were mostly with the Wanderers, you know, because they were the ones, like, I have 21 cousins on that side. On the Hefner side, on my mother's side, I have one. And he lived in Virginia. So really, we spent most of our time with the Wanderers.
Okay. Were there any sports that you played in school?
Not in school. Back then, girls didn't play sports. Mm-hmm. Title IX or whatever it was hadn't been enacted. And, you know, a little bit in grade school, like, you know, I don't know why I was trying to play basketball, but way too short for that. Mm. But so I remember the basketball part of it. But as far as sports through school, that was it. That's all I remember.
Okay. What was your housing like growing up?
Just a detached white house on the south side of Spokane, kind of like every, you know, other house in the neighborhood.
Did you have any chores that you did as a child?
Yeah, we were supposed to do them. We were, you know, mom was pretty big on assigning kids work, because why should she do it all, you know? Mm-hmm. So I always set the table. I always had to, like, dust mop. We had hardwood floors, and so dust mopping. I think we made our own beds. Dishes, we did the dishes. Yeah.
Now, you said you went to Catholic school. What are your strongest mm-hmm. memories of school?
You know, it was a good experience, I think, overall. Mostly kind of a lot of camaraderie and a real group thing. Especially in grade school, we did not get shifted. We had like two classrooms of every grade. And we did not get shifted, like mixed up, mm-hmm. you know. We spent the same kids. And that was kind of nice, actually. You know, they probably would have done it different had they thought, but I thought it was kind of nice. And to this day, like, we had a high school reunion about 5 years ago, and the night before we had a St. Augustine's reunion because we found we always wound up talking to each other at these high school reunions. So we thought we might as well have a grade school reunion. And so so that was kind of nice. We just kind of all knew each other. When we went to high school, there were kids from all over the city, you know, in Spokane that came to the high school. And actually, you know, the academic standards were much higher than the public schools. The nuns, I think, really liked their subjects, you know, and they were, since they were unmarried without children and they had diocesan funds, they did graduate work every summer. And so they were good at what they did and they liked what they did, you know. You know, I remember people just wild about chemistry and English and algebra and stuff like that. So I think it was a good education.
That's nice. So did your family go on any regular sort of outings or holidays?
Not really. Until I was about 10, maybe, maybe 8, we came to Montana, to Hamilton, for almost every holiday. And I think somewhere along the line, Dad kind of realized that we were on lousy roads at Thanksgiving and lousy roads, you know, at Christmas. And it was nothing like the interstates now. I mean, Lookout Pass was 2-lane, narrow, windy. I remember it being really scared on Lookout Pass almost every time we drove it. And I don't remember being scared really of anything else in my childhood, but Lookout Pass, it's just like, oh God, deliver me. It was horrible. So somewhere along the line, we stopped coming to Hamilton and just staying home. And I actually kind of liked that, especially for Christmas.
Since you grew up in a fairly in a Catholic community and in an Irish community, mm-hmm. were there any sort of community traditions where you all got together and celebrated certain things together?
Not as Irish, no. There were some people, like, it just cracked me up. A lot of the attorneys in town and a lot of the fathers of the girls I went to school with were attorneys, were Irish Catholic, you know. And I, you know, I would hear stories of them having this party and they called Northern Ireland to try to, or somewhere in Ireland to try to volunteer and send money and stuff, you know. It just cracked me up. I just thought that was the funniest thing. And Mr. Gillespie, he was really a kick. He was an attorney too, and he took a gun down to the Manitou Park one time and shot a goose for like Christmas dinner. This is so totally illegal. So it was always kind of fun, you know. Oh, and the Cooneys. Oh, Maureen Cooney was one of my best friends. And her family, her dad just cracked me up. His kind of motto was, you know, don't go around lying all the time. Save it up for when you really need it. You know, I just loved the Goonies. They were great.
That's funny. Were there big celebrations for St. Patrick's Day?
Not in Spokane. I don't remember really ever seeing one. I don't remember a parade, nothing. There was a big parade for Lilac Day in May for, you know, the city, but I do not remember anything for St. Patrick's Day.
Did your family do anything for St. Patrick's Day?
Mm-mm, not that I remember.
How do you think these communities that were important to you as a child have changed over the years?
Well, they've kind of gotten bigger. Hamilton's bigger. It's got a lot more highly educated people because of the lab, although the lab was there way a long time ago. Helmville isn't much bigger. it's got a lot of people from that are not from Montana in it now. So that's changed. Although comparatively speaking, I think Helmville is a phenomenally, if you look at the records of the names, like I've got a cookbook with different names in it and stuff. It's just amazing. There's been a lot of continuity of family in Helmville. And so that probably hasn't changed a ton, but and the state overall has really changed a lot, because when I was here in the 70s and when I was a little girl and stuff, it was very, very isolated state, very large but very isolated, and we kind of marched to our own drummer. You know, it was like 15, 20 years behind the rest of the country, and that was fine. You know, and since then, you know, people move more now. And so there's a lot of people not from Montana, especially Missoula, you know. And so it's a little different. It's much more like other towns now in the United States rather than having its own character. But
how have historical events affected your family and community? For example, did your family, do you know of, experience any anti-Catholic actions or sentiment from the KKK?
Actually, it was kind of lack of that was interesting. When my father was first posted after training in World War II, he was in the Army Air Corps, and he was down south. And I think the first posting that he had was at, Monroe, Louisiana, and he was training navigators. And he and Mom had just married, so after he left, like one day after the wedding, and then she joined him later. And so she had to find housing. And I mean, this was a challenge down there. I mean, there just wasn't housing. They had all these, you know, people, new people in town and stuff. And they were Catholic, you know, at least Mother was. And Dad had actually been raised a Catholic and had the sacraments and stuff. He wasn't practicing. But, and so Mom had to go out and find an apartment. And Dad said that he thought, you know, well, I don't know where we're going to wind up living, kind of thing, you know. And Mom was just very much a people person, and she had a great apartment with a really nice landlady within a day, you know. And, you know, Dad said, well, that was Marjorie, you know, and that was the way she took care of it. So it was kind of more of a lack of problem that was marked then.
That's good. Problem. Do you know anything about how your family experienced the Depression?
Down in Hamilton, my grandfather had a store, and it was right on Main Street. And my aunt and my dad always said that they didn't know, they weren't wealthy, but they didn't know they were poor, you know, because they had a grocery store. So it wasn't like they were the ones ever looking, to eat and stuff. I know my grandfather was extremely generous, and Dad said there were a lot of times Dad would be delivering groceries, you know, and he'd go in and Granny Pop would tell him, just leave the groceries on the table, don't collect, you know. So Granny Pop gave away a lot back then, and helped a lot of people. And actually, that's a real strong trait in the family. And then my other grandfather up on the ranch in Helmville, that's probably what did in the ranch is the Depression, you know. He bought a herd of registered Herefords, and my father always felt that that's probably what did it. It just was too expensive, and it was like in the 30s, early 30s, so.
That's too bad. Did any of your family serve in World War II?
Yeah. My dad served. He was a navigator trainer. And he actually got drafted accidentally in Helena. And my mom didn't want him to go, but he said, oh, I'll go. It was before Pearl Harbor, same year. And he goes, yeah, I'll go. He said, I'll just walk around for a couple years. That's all it's going to take, you know, to win this war and just figure out what I want to do. Well, phew. You know, he went over to Fort Lewis. he said it was, they'd taken this test, and he never told me this, but other people did tell me this. He got the highest score anybody had ever gotten on that test that they gave anybody. And so they were like, okay, you're going in the Army Air Corps, which was kind of for the cream of the crop, you know. And he had volunteered for the infantry. You know, he thought that'd be fine. You know, walk around in a circle for a couple of years. And so he said there were 300 guys. It was a dark, rainy night at Fort Lewis. They were all on one side of the street, and they called out 299 names to fall out on the other side of the street, and they were going somewhere for the infantry. Dad was the one that they accepted into the Army Air Corps. And he goes, naturally, it was the Army. They didn't call out the one that could have gone to the Army Air Corps. They called out the 299 that they were going somewhere else, you know. And then they sent him down to Fort Mather, I think it was. And he was down there when Pearl Harbor was bombed. And he was actually, that Sunday, he was off duty, and he was out on a beach, like at a picnic with a couple people, and heard it on the radio. And he had pretty big concern, because he said by the time he got back to the base, it was dark and they were shooting. You know, so I don't know exactly how he got in, but he didn't get shot. And so from there, they sent him to navigator's training. He was in a program, I think it was 9 months long. There were 3 months left, and he graduated at the top of the class. They put him in that late. And he never made a big deal of that stuff, ever. You know, my mother told me that. So my mom and my grandparents and stuff all went down for graduation, and then he and mom got married in September 42, and went down to Monroe, Louisiana. And Dad spent most of the war there. He did go to Tampa after, I think it was after they had won the war in Europe, and they were realigning everyone. Like people who hadn't gone overseas were going to go and things like that, and people who were over there were getting to come back. And so he was scheduled to go with a crew to the Pacific when they were called up, and basically the bomb got dropped before that happened. So the war was over. And then my oldest uncle on that side of the family couldn't serve. He had been in a train accident and had a bad foot. My Uncle Ralph served in the Army Air Corps also. He was a pilot. He was at Pearl Harbor when Pearl Harbor was bombed. I went with him in 79 over to Honolulu in Hawaii, and he took me to the house where he and Margaret had been. They were having breakfast, and you know, they just, you know, heard planes. Well, of course you hear planes, you know, they're on a base, you know. And he said all of a sudden it dawned on them, they were hearing shooting, and this was not, you know, this was the real thing. So anyway, he was at Pearl Harbor and also served in the Pacific, and he made a career of it. And then my dad's younger brother Steve was also in the Army Air Corps. He was a bombardier, and he died in Burma in, I think, 44. It's really too bad. I asked my dad about it once, and what had happened is they were on some kind of intelligence mission with the English. You know, the guy who was running the mission was English. And the plane they picked for the mission did not have the ability to make the altitude of the, I mean, it was just very, they could have prevented that one, you know. And the whole crew died, and they're buried in Arlington in one grave. And their younger brother, Tommy, he served in the infantry, and he was in the Philippines and died at Luzon. So they lost 2 out of 4 in the war. And then on mom's side, there wasn't anybody to be in the service. Her brother-in-law was in the service, but Mary's husband, but... So basically, everybody of that age in the family served if they could.
So does your family have any special sayings or expressions?
I don't think so. I don't think so. We pretty much smart Alex, but it's all new material.
How are holidays traditionally celebrated in your family?
basically the families celebrate their own now because we're so, you know, one brother's in New York, one is in Seattle, my sister's in California, and I'm here. So kind of we've been like that actually ever since Mom died in 73. We pretty much haven't come back to Montana. So
what holidays are most important?
It might depend on the person. To me, I really like Thanksgiving. It's not as, I don't know, I just like it. It's just kind of more low-key, you know?
Not quite as...
harried as Christmas, you know?
Understandable. Are there specific food traditions, either for holidays or just in general, that your family...
Actually not. And the reason is because my mother didn't like to cook, and she didn't like to eat. And so, I mean, we all grew up, it was fine. It was, you know, food was there. It was always there. It was always hot on the table. And it really worked out well because my dad only wanted a plate of hot food. He didn't care what it tasted like, really, you know. And so that worked out really well. So mother always did that, you know. And she could cook. She grew up on a ranch, you know. I never saw a biscuit until I was like 8 at my aunt's house. I didn't know what a biscuit was. I mean, things like that. I mean, things that other people really take for granted. It's like we did not have them in my house. I never saw her bake a pie, which actually is okay because I don't really like pie. So it was kind of funny. It was not a big deal at our house.
Huh, interesting. Do you have any family heirlooms or keepsakes that have passed down?
I think I wrote that down, actually. Not a lot, I'll tell you that. That pin that I mentioned, going to Sons and Daughters of Montana Pioneers, that was, and I didn't even know that it was that big a deal, but it was, apparently. Everybody was really glad to see it. And so that's probably one of the bigger things. My mom has a jewelry box with costume jewelry, and I've started to give that away to my niece. I only have one niece, and then 3 nephews have married. And so we actually took pictures while my sister-in-law was here last week of, it's just costume jewelry, you know, but some of it's really nice, you know, crystal and stuff. And so we took pictures of it, and we're gonna put it on the internet and let the girls tell us what the ones they want, you know, because somebody might have a real interest in one thing but not in another and stuff like that. So you might as well get it out there and get it going. I did give a bracelet to my niece, my nephew's wife, actually, about a month ago. July 4th was her birthday. And Tatiana is actually Russian, and her family moved over when she was 14. And so she has nothing in her family, nothing. Not one scrap of written history, not one item, nothing. And she really appreciates that kind of stuff. And so Mom had a black bracelet with a lot of crystal on it, and it was pretty high quality costume jewelry. The company is still in business, and so I sent that to her, and she liked it. So I'm divesting myself of those things. And the other things I have to say is that over the last 2-3 years, I have given away a ton of stuff that we had. Like, we had brochures from Lewis and Clark Caverns in the 1960s, and we're talking books, you know, just pristine condition. We bought them there when we were there on vacation. Things from Yellowstone from our 1960 trip. Postcards, a ton of postcards from a whole bunch of different places. And some of them were this guy who has a museum in the Midwest named after him because he was such a famous photographer for postcards. So I sent them back to him, you know. So for the last 2 or 3 years, I've really donated a lot of stuff like that that I didn't think anybody in the family wanted, you know, and yet they were kind of niche things where other people might want to take a look at them. I've done a lot of donation of photography, like this photograph I donated to Museum of the Rockies. So those things. And actually I guess that isn't so much a donation. I took a couple pictures down to the Missoulian a couple weeks ago of the fair in 1936. Mom took a couple pictures from the top of the Ferris wheel. And so we'll see. They may print them, they may not. They printed three pictures in the paper and one in a, in a magazine so far. And let me grab the one that I really like the best. This one was copied off of a very small 2x2 photograph. And I took a look at it one day, and I've been looking at it for years. And I thought, you know, that's really nice.
Oh, that is a beautiful photograph.
Yeah, that's my mother on the ranch in Helmville. And it was kind of a struggle to get a good copy because it was such a small. And then I lost the original. So we have a lot of ranch pictures. That's what a lot of these are.
Well, that's really nice. Has anybody in your family like put together scrapbooks, genealogies, family trees?
This stuff. This stuff was from my mom, so she put those together. And then, and we have, this is the Hefner box. We have a couple boxes of Wanderer stuff too. And then I'm the one that's been doing the genealogy. And so a couple, last summer maybe it was, I took the stuff in Ancestry that I've got and did a poster. And their posters are frightful. They're like $40 each, but they're nice quality. Mm-hmm. And then I copied it and sent it to all my cousins just to get it out there, you know. It's not finished. It's not done. There's a lot of stuff missing, but there's a lot of stuff there that none of us ever knew before. So
that's really nice. Have you or any of your family members traveled to Ireland?
No. Actually, my nephew has, but on business. And he's somewhere in Northern Ireland when he goes. I think it might be Dublin. And I've been meaning to, first of all, find out where in County Wexford my, you know, ancestors were from. And then also, I know I have that map somewhere of the Gallaghers, what town in County Mayo they were from. And then give that information to him and just say, you know, Michael, I don't know if you'll ever have time to, you know, because I guess it takes a while to go sightsee, you know. But if you do, here's where, you know, the family's from. And apparently he's real appreciative. Like, I gave him a page out of one of those books, photograph albums, and framed it for his wedding. It was haying at the ranch, and it had four really nice photographs on it, and just well-placed and just really nice. And then I gave him a pair of two pair of horseshoes, actually, that were welded together. They were from the big workhorses on the ranch, and they were bookends. And they've been painted black, and I don't even remember where I got them. I think someone in the 70s gave them to me from the Helmville, Mrs. Blankenship, probably from the ranch. And so I gave him those also for his wedding. And apparently my brother said he really, really likes those, so.
Have you ever had the desire to go to Ireland? Do you want to do that someday?
Yeah, I'd love to go to Ireland. I'm not sure I ever will. I tend to really do badly with the time change, and I get sick, really sick, instantly, you know, within the first 24 hours, you know. And so I've always felt like, well, if I get a really bad diagnosis, I'm going anyway, you know. Who cares if you get sick, you know. But if I find out, like, especially the County Wexford people, and then somewhere, like I say, I've got this information on the County Mayo, I'd love to go and find where they actually were, because I love that. There's places in this state, there's places in Illinois, there's been places in Maine where I have gone specifically because I know ancestors were born there and lived there, and it's really nice.
Have you ever partaken in any traditions or rituals specifically of Irish origin? Have you ever been to an Irish wake or anything of that nature?
I haven't.
Okay.
An Irish St. Patrick's Day parade in New Orleans was as close as I got, which was fun. They, you know what they did there? Hilarious. Oh, I just love the Irish. Their sense of humor is just great. From the floats, and they did the parade in the quarter, which means it's done on cars and small vehicles instead of the great big ones. And their throws, which are, you know, they do, you know, the beads and all that kind of stuff. Well, they also throw potatoes and cabbages on the St. Patrick's Day parade, and I caught a cabbage. Still there.
That's fabulous. Do you know of any traditional home cures or remedies that your family may have used?
not a lot, probably bag balm, and it's not really a home cure. It's just...
Were there any commonly held superstitions or ghost stories in your family?
There were a few. You know, there's something about if a bird flies into your window and dies, that's a bad omen, and I think it's just kind of like calamity, you know? And my mom, I do remember her saying one time that a bird flew into the window at the ranch and died, and somebody said something, and turns out somebody had died that day that they didn't know about yet. And my mom was really kind of very, she didn't say a lot, but she kind of had a sixth sense that was very strong. When you went to the racehorses with her, if she knew the horse was going to win, it would. I mean, it wasn't a joke. You wouldn't bet on it, you know? And when my sister got pregnant, she knew someone in the family was pregnant. And I had two sister-in-laws and a sister, and she knew one of them was pregnant. So she called them all up and asked. And at the time, I think Mary didn't even know. I'm not too sure she did know, you know? And she asked me, and she goes, "Who's pregnant?" And I'm going, "What?" You know, I was a freshman in college. It was like, And so, and my sister has that. She has a real strong sixth sense. And I mean, one time there was something that happened with Dad with business, and she did not know what was going on. I did know kind of some of the background and stuff. She didn't. She was living in Spokane. We were here in Missoula. She called my dad that night, and she said, "What's going on?" And she knew, and she really does. And me, I don't want to know. I don't want it. I've always felt like I could have that kind of, you know, and nope, you know, as far as I'm concerned, the other world can stay away, you know. I don't want any part. It scares me. Mm-hmm. I don't like it, so.
That's understandable. What would you say have been the most striking changes in your life so far?
I guess the biggest change came when I graduated from school, because, you know, by then you actually have a degree, you know, and that was a big deal for a couple reasons. One is that I finally got done, but also it was in engineering, and I always did want to know that stuff, but I didn't know quite where that information was, because it's in a lot of different, you know, architecture, engineering, that kind of stuff. There's a lot of different aspects to it, and I also didn't think I could do it. I was convinced I couldn't do math. You know, that was all the way through high school, and just couldn't do it. Well, it was the only thing I ever needed to do my homework in, is what really turned out, and I never did my homework, past everything else, so, you know, why should I bother, you know? So when I finally started doing my homework, and it was like, oh, okay, all right. You know, I graduated, and so it was a big deal for me, because it was kind of like having conquered a fear, you know, that I could do it, and I just went ahead and did it. And the other thing was that at the time, and it's not so much right now with the economy, but, you know, engineering was the in-demand profession. And so you wound up getting employed at a good job. And I mean, mine was good. I went to work for Washington State first, but when the Park Service called, I went for them, you know. And, you know, you can't even imagine what it's like to get paid to go to these national parks and work. And other people pay to go on vacation there, you know. And we would go and work and live and, you know, inspect construction for 6 months or so. And it was just fantastic, you know. And when I went into Denver, all our field work was out in the parks, because those were our customers, you know. And so it was really the best job you could have had, you know. And I did that for a total of about 12 years. And so the change there, just, you know, it's like graduation day made a huge change in employability, you know, mm-hmm. and also what I could do. I got to do what I wanted to do, and I got to do it where it was just really interesting. So that was a big one. Coming back to Montana, I don't work for the Park Service anymore. I work for the Army Corps. And that was big, because I just quit moving, you know. People were really hard-pressed to believe it, because I had moved so much, and I liked all that, you know, change. And when I was in the Virgin Islands, I looked around, and I had a two-year tour of duty there, and it was coming up, and I knew I was going to be leaving, and I thought, where do I want to go? And before, I'd always had somewhere I wanted to go, you know, like, let's another little adventure type thing. That one, it was like, I don't know where I want to go. And finally I looked around, and all those people on that teeny tiny 9 mile long island, you know, knew each other. They knew where they, you know, where grandma was, where auntie was, where everybody was all the time. And I remember thinking, I remember where I used to live, and I used to, you know, go out and see people I knew, you know. And I thought, oh, I want to go back to Missoula. You know, that was the first time I'd felt like that. And this job came up, and it was exactly what my experience had been. And so it worked perfectly. So probably those two things.
Are there any other stories about your ancestors you'd like to share before we wrap up?
Yeah, there's a couple. I wrote a couple down. And these ones were told to me by Charles Gallagher, who was my grandmother's cousin, and he's called Charles Gallagher Jr. His dad was the last of the 14 to come to the United States. And he, the way I found him, actually I found him when I was looking for Bridget, and I got an obituary from the Helena for the Monsignor, and it mentioned there were two Charles H. Gallaghers from Butte that had come. One was an uncle, and one was a cousin. So I thought to myself the next day, I thought, you know, I wonder if that Charles, the younger one, is still alive. So I called information, and yes, there was a Charles H. Gallagher, but hey, you know, it's not an uncommon name. So I called him, and he answered the phone, and I said, you know, I was looking for that I was looking for a Charles H. Gallagher, and he said, that's me. And I said, actually, I'm looking for a Charles H. Gallagher that's related to a Bridget Gallagher Cavanaugh. And he said, she was my aunt. And I almost died. I was like, just speechless. I was like, really? You are my relative? I didn't know I had any living Irish relatives. You know, I was just like, and he was the nicest man. So we talked a while, and he goes, oh, I know Gus and Elizabeth, which are my grandparents. He goes, I knew their daughters, which was my mother and my aunt. And I was going, wow, you know? So I went over and met him. About a month later in Butte, and we sat and talked at Denny's. And so he was the one who gave me the map and told me a lot about the family, you know. And then he said his brother, Thomas Kevin Gallagher, it was his mother, Laura Kelly, had married Charles H. Gallagher Sr. And before that, she was a school teacher. And her, I think it was a sister-in-law or something, was a school teacher also. And they taught in the Butte school system. And at that point, they had tons of, you know, miners' kids coming in. And a lot of them didn't speak English. They're literally right off the boat from the foreign country, you know. And so what they would do if they had a child that they didn't recognize the language, you know, they would just stand the child up in front of the class and have him talk and see who could recognize it, what language it was, you know. And apparently there usually was somebody, and then they'd pair the two up so that the person who'd been here a while would teach the other kid English and the ways of the world in America, you know. And so that's what they did for their children, so that they could orient them to, you know, life in America, which was really considerate, instead of letting all those kids hang out there alone, you know, not speaking English and not knowing what was going on, you know. And actually, you can, I think I've read that actually documented somewhere. And then one other thing he mentioned was that they, like, his family had a telephone. And most of the kids didn't, because they just couldn't afford it. And so the teachers would use the Gallagher telephone as a training tool. And what they'd do is send Charles H. Jr. home to answer it. And then they'd line up the kids in front of the principal's office and teach him how to dial a telephone and what to say, you know, like, hello, is somebody there, you know. And they'd have Charles H. on the other end answering the telephone and answering the questions and all this kind of stuff, because the teachers knew they would never know how to dial a telephone otherwise. They wouldn't know that, you know, and which is really nice. I mean, that's life skills training, you know. That's really practical. We can't believe it now, but that's what they were doing back then. And let me see, there was a couple other things. Oh, his dad, Charles H. Gallagher Sr., he was really quite, he was the youngest of the kids to come over, and definitely the most successful financially, you know, and in business and stuff, probably, you know, they were all smarter than heck. I really had to say when I walked away after talking to Charles Gallagher Jr., I thought, no wonder we all went to college. You know, he was one very bright man. And his dad probably had the benefit of all, you know, a bunch of siblings in the area, you know, that could maybe knew people, you know, or helped him or whatever. But he worked at a grocery store. That was his first job. And he did that for a while. I've read his obituary. And then he wound up buying one. And he wound up with six stores in, I think, mostly the Butte area, like Deer Lodge and things like that. And he had the first self-service grocery store in the state. Everything else was, you know, you go into the counter and you tell them what you want and they go get it for you. And he had the first self-service one in the entire state. And, oh, this is really a good one. This was told to me at Charles H. Jr.'s funeral, which was about a year and a half after I met him. One of the relatives on the Kelly side of their family, you know, was talking to me. And he goes, well, you know, he goes, Charles H. Sr., he goes, sued the Anaconda Company. And I said, really? You know? And he goes, yeah, at the time they were using script instead of money, paying their people in script instead of money, and so they could only shop at the company stores. And Charles sued and won and didn't die. That's the surprising part. That's the surprising part.
Yeah.
And that was a real landmark case, and he won. And so... there was a lot going on in Butte.
Wow.
Yep. So.
Okay, well, I have one final question for you.
Mm-hmm.
If you were to write the history of the Irish in Montana, what would you want to include for future generations?
I'd include the fact that they seem to be very hardworking. They seem to be smart. They seem to also love their homeland, you know, and kind of want to preserve the ties instead of, you know, break the ties. You know, I think everybody always has a pride in their heritage, but, you know, I know my great-grandfather, Hefner, he would not speak German after he came to this country. He would not. He said, I'm an American. I'm not, no. And even when there were newcomers, he wouldn't speak. So I guess those. Just family ties. They, you know, it seems like family ties were important.
All right. Well, thank you for allowing me to interview you today. It was a very nice interview.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.